This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Blank Podcast, a podcast where we talk to well-known guests about their lives, their careers, and navigating those difficult moments on the way. I'm Giles Pay-Phillips, and with me is Jim Daly.
Hello, hello, hello. How are you?
That sounded like the start of a song. Hello,
hello, hello, hello. Hello.
And how are you?
Maybe we should start the pods by doing
I've been
songs,
to the musical. Bathroom and done a big poo.
Wow, it's like living with my three-year-old.
Yeah.
She's obsessed that she's in a real toilet humour phase.
Oh, I love that phase. I've not grown out of that, unfortunately. At the age of 45.
Everything is poo. Like, everything is poo, and it's just apparently it's hilarious.
Yeah.
And then she was saying last night, she's waking up in the middle of the night at the moment, and like she is potty training, so I guess it is poo is her world. But everything's toilet. She was saying she come up with a game. The game's called Toilet, and one of her has to be a toilet, the other one has to be toilet roll. Maria, where are you getting these
so
ideas?
So funny,
from?
Isn't it? So funny.
Oh dear. Anyway, kids are hilarious. What's happening?
Oh, what's happening? Oh, all sorts. You know, it's January. It's coming to an end. Well, we're in February now, aren't we, I think?
No, it's February.
Yeah, yeah. January. So January's finished. I think, I have to admit, I think I've been feeling a bit January bluesy. I think that's quite a lot of people have been saying that. But now there's a little bit more sunshine's coming out. And yeah. February, apparently, is the month where things start to happen. So I've been told.
Okay.
So hopefully lots of exciting things will happen during February and we'll be all excited and happy again.
January is rubbish, isn't it?
It drags. Like, it's so long, isn't it? It feels like 2 months.
It does. I think just even being in February, I think, is positive enough. Can I do a quick shout out to my solo show? It is this week. So this is the last time I'll do it. But this Thursday, the 9th of Feb, I'm doing my Edinburgh show at the Bill Murray Pub in Angel, which is a brilliant, brilliant comedy venue. I think it's at £8. It's at 6:30 p.m. And it's a 4-star rated stand-up comedy.
It's so good, isn't it?
Show and it's a lot of fun, very silly, family friendly, and tickets are available from angelcomedy.co.uk. If you're in town, fancy coming along for an hour, then I'd love to see you there, and I'll be in the bar afterwards as well.
My old band Little Ten had a song called Bill Murray.
Well, I mean, he's just, I just think I was about to say, oh, potential 200th episode guest, but I think we're probably too late for that. But he is a legend, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, he is. One of the lyrics in it, I didn't write the lyrics, our singer Joe did, but one of the lyrics was, looks like Nicholson without the glow, which was great. But our bass players...
I like that.
Yeah. So, like, you know, obviously Jack Nicholson, so I can get the reference. But our bass player's brother didn't know the lyrics and thought the lyric was, he looks like Jackson without the glove.
Very different.
Which very, very different, yeah. Anyway, that just popped into my head. Very
great.
Random and niche reference to my old band. But you can listen to that song on Spotify.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. I might do that and sing Jackson Without the Glove along.
Yeah, I would. Look, we need to talk about today's guest who,
oh my God,
what an honour and a privilege to have on. An absolute legend of the BBC. I mean, 50 plus years as a BBC correspondent, mainly as a foreign correspondent, and has been in multiple war zones and conflicts and in the most difficult circumstances on earth. It's the one and only John Simpson, who, you know, I think we both, when he started talking, his voice, he's so recognisable. You know, there's so many of those BBC institutions. I mean, we've had John Motson on the podcast before, and he's another one of those people whose voice is so distinctive, you recognize it straight away. And Simpson's got the same thing. It's very, very recognizable, and Yeah, and what a conversation. I mean, so much stuff that, and we could have talked to him for hours and hours. There's so much stuff that we didn't cover, but we, I mean, hopefully we covered enough stuff for our listeners. But what a brilliant, brilliant person, and what a lovely human being as well. Like, just great to be in his company for an hour.
Oh my word, what a nice guy. Like, I just, and actually, I mean, the BBC war correspondent, you know, I mean, the daddy. The daddy of war corresponding. I mean, the guy's, you know, at one point he said he's counted 10 times his life's been at risk. I mean, that the commitment to the job there, and we do talk, that does come up and we ask him about that. It's just incredible, really. And what an inspiration he's probably been for hundreds of, maybe even more, reporters down the years since to get into journalism. And just, but just a lovely guy, like just so easy to talk to and just... But yeah, another one we could have sat down absolutely for hours as well. And we do, I did ask him what I thought was quite a silly question that turned into a fantastic story right at the end for our patrons.
About, yeah, it's great,
well, I won't even say, about his first day on the job as a reporter. So it's like from a sitcom or from a movie. So do check that out in our Patreon where we do extra content each week at patreon.com, patreon.com/blankpodcast. But just... Oh, John, what a legend. Just, yeah. I mean, these I love doing this pod anyway, but like, this is one of those ones that's like, put a spring in my step for the rest of my day. I just want to.
Yeah, and I just want to go back. I'm looking forward, I'm actually looking forward to, like, you know, editing it. Like, not that we edit much of the conversation, but like, just going back and putting the music on and everything. For people who don't know, we try not to edit the actual conversations, try and keep them as live. But, yeah, I'm just looking forward to listening back to all the, you know, wonderful things he says. And obviously we asked him, you know, quite a lot of stuff about his career and stuff. But then we were asking him sort of some of the insights on the current conflict in the Ukraine as well, which he's obviously very knowledgeable and insightful about. I mean, very, very, that was very, very interesting. And I took a lot on board from that as well. But just so many different anecdotes and, like, you know, just the various different things that he's... been involved with and seen, you know, and, you know, there's some emotional bits in there, isn't there, as well? Like, I got, you know, I think both of us probably got a bit emotional, and John did as well. So, yeah, lots of brilliant moments.
Yeah. I mean, again, if you're talking about, you know, the authority, really, on the conflict in Ukraine. So that's all obviously very, very interesting as well, and some interesting insight into Putin and the sort of man he is as well. So... Well, so many someone, takeaways from this one.
And someone John has met on multiple occasions. So I think he's in a very good position to talk wisely on that stuff.
I think we should just get into it because we've teased it enough now. But this is an absolute banger of an episode.
I've got a couple of tweets I'd like to read out first, Jim, if I may, because we haven't had any tweets for a little while. So after the Martin O'Neill episode, which was seemed to go down very well with our listeners, I think we've garnered some new listeners as well. So we've got Washed Up Cards on Twitter, who says, "I'm so thrilled to have now come across your podcast. Love listening to the Martin O'Neill episode." which was really lovely. It's very nice to have new listeners. We're always welcome. And people do want to get in touch with us, Jim. They can't they?
Yeah, can I just say, Washed Up Cards, I've just clicked on their account. We don't normally do shout-outs to people, but they create cards using bits of plastic washed up on beaches around the UK.
Oh, amazing.
Lovely. So I'm going to do them a shout-out, at Washed Up Cards. I'm going to follow them now from all our accounts. Definitely worth... following, I would say, because that's
brilliant,
superb.
Yeah,
and thank you for listening to the pod.
Yeah, and I've got another one here from Margaret Ann. So she's Margaret Mac 53. She listened to the Andrew Gower one. She said, "What a smashing episode! Great to hear Andrew Gower." And she also complimented us on the picture we chose of him as well. So it's obviously one that she's obviously a bigger fan of Andrew. And he's looking very dashing in it. To be fair,
I mean, there are no bad photos of Andrew Gower.
No, he's a good looking chap.
We could have picked any photo. But anyway, yes, you can get in contact with us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Our handle is the exact same for all of them. It is
at Blank Pod.
It is indeed. I think, and we'd love to hear from you whether you enjoy the episode or whether you like the photos. We'll take any feedback. Right, I think we should crack on with this week's episode, shouldn't we? This is an absolute banger of an episode. And you're going to, hopefully, like us, like me and Giles, once the voice kicks in from our guest, you will be taken back to hearing countless radio reports and TV reports. This is the one and only, the legend that is John Simpson on the Blank Podcast.
John Simpson, thank you so much for being with us today. I mean, it is a genuine pleasure and privilege and honour to have you on the podcast. Huge, huge fan of what you do and obviously the remarkable career you've had. Now, with our podcast, we generally start at the beginning of people's journeys. And I wanted to know really what, as a child, were you, it feels like, you know, obviously all the stuff you've done, you know, and being a journalist and a reporter, you've lived a life of curiosity. And I wondered if that was something you had as a young child. Were you a curious child?
I was, and I was quite an adventurous kid too. I was an only child, and we lived in the depths of the country for a lot of the time in Suffolk. It was just, and my mother, I think quite reasonably, left my dad and me when I was six, I think. And so it was just him and me for most of the time. So it was quite lonely. And there wasn't, you know, there was always kind of things to explore and do and look at. And he himself was an immensely sociable, quite a very difficult man, but very sociable and great fun, actually. And when he was a kid, when he was, I think, either 15 or 16, not sure which, he ran away to sea from his parents, who were also pretty difficult. And he went and became a steward on the P&O lines around the world.
Wow.
He had a fantastic time for 10 years traveling to Australia and India and South Africa and everything. So I had this kind of background always from him about other countries, other places. And I suppose it just kind of sank in, really. And I was quite adventurous. I mean, I did things that you know, no sensible parent would allow a kid to do. You know, climbing trees and climbing up buildings and exploring places. And so it was a lonely childhood, but it wasn't a sort of contemplative one. It was quite an exciting one in some ways.
So even though your world at the time was quite small, your horizons were much, much bigger, whereas I guess a lot of people sometimes their horizons are smaller maybe, but you clearly had your mind or your heart set on these far-reaching places.
Yeah, exactly that. My dad always used to say, oh God, you know, London, because we lived in London for part of the time. London, you know, it's so bloody provincial. You know, they don't know anything about the outside world. Well, that was the 1950s. It ain't provincial any longer, I'm glad to say. And he would have loved it, actually, now. That was right. There was always that sense that, you know, you should be that. Any sensible person would have their eyes on a wider horizon, that it not just, you know, this house, this street, this suburb, this village, this whatever, but you know, there's a whole world out there, and by God, you ought to take part in it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so did you, I mean, obviously your father traveled a lot. Were you able to travel yourself a lot at that time with him, or was that something that he just did kind of solo?
No, dear old boy. I mean, we did have our differences, but he was always prepared to fund my travel. So he and I mean, I think probably 17 or 18 before I actually went abroad.
Oh, okay.
For the first time, and characteristically it was in the middle of the awful winter of 1962 to 63, and He got sick of everything, and he said, "We're going to." I promise you, this is true. He said, "We're going to go to Casablanca." And I said, "Where's it showing?" "You bloody idiot! The place, the place!" And we went to Casablanca again. You know, nobody ever went to Casablanca in 1961, 62, and then. Just before I went to university, he funded a trip for me to America, and I wandered around for four or five months, extraordinary adventures with, I traveled around, I was driven around by a mafia kind of hitman.
Wow.
And he told me all about it all in detail that I didn't want to know. I'm still trying to get out of my mind. And then at the end of that trip, we had a bus stop in the end, and I left him. He was very, I have to say, you know, very nice hitman, very pleasant. And
of all the hitmans I've met, he's probably the nicest.
He was, I think, probably the most charming, yes. And then I met a girl in, well, in Boston, but she came from Southern California. So I got back on my dear old father, who didn't have very much money, was suddenly landed with the prospect that I was going to go through as many of the university holidays as I could to Southern California, which in that those days was like saying, you know, I'd like to go to Tonga or something. I mean, it was a huge way away. And he funded three trips, I think, of mine to Southern California. And then I married the girl in the end. And that was all very, very pleasant. But, you know, there was a sense always that the world was there, that it wasn't just him and me, and it wasn't just in our house, that there was an enormous world. And, you know, I think his line was, I don't want to, you know, I'm not really very keen on spending all this money, but on the other hand, it's a good cause, which I don't think many people would necessarily have said at that stage.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got so many follow-up questions from this. Firstly, I'm wondering how many people went to Casablanca after the movie came out in the 40s and 50s. When the Casablanca Tourism Board must have done amazing.
Can I tell you somebody who did go? He and I were there on New Year's Eve, 1962-3. And there was a really odd-looking woman. I mean, I could see she was very attractive, but she acted very weird. And I said to my dad, have you seen that weird woman? This was a party in a restaurant. No, it wasn't a party really, but it was one of those things where, you know, you came and joined in for the New Year festivities. And he looked over and he said, my God, that's Zsa Zsa Gabor. And my father, I have to say, was everybody found him was amazingly sort of good looking and a rather glamorous figure. And she made eye contact with him. He made eye contact with Zsa Zsa Gabor. By the end of the evening, and she was unfortunately there with a young, much younger kind of toy boy who didn't take to my father at all. And so at the end of the evening, I said, well, you know, time to go back to the hotel, I suppose. And my dad said, go back. And he didn't come back for 2 days.
Wow.
And when he did, he had a tremendous black eye. I mean, obviously somebody, either Zsa Zsa Gabor, but more likely, I think, the toy boy, had dropped one on him. And I said, hey, how about that? But, you know, and he said, look, don't ever ask about it. Okay? I never actually ever did.
What happens in Casablanca stays in Casablanca.
I knew, John, talking to you would be full of stories. We're 10 minutes in already. We've got travels to the mafia and getting punched by Zsa Zsa Gabor. This is an episode for the ages. It's so lovely hearing about your travels. And I was lucky enough to be brought up by parents who also took me abroad from a very early age. We moved to Hong Kong when I was six, and then Dubai a year later, and then Spain for a few years. And I also later in life got to live in Southern California for a bit as well. So very much appreciate, I absolutely love the people there. I love that place. So it's I'm very much sort of in the same realm as you, as this idea of the world is bigger than, and if you're lucky enough to go and lucky enough to experience it. But what I'm really hearing is this support you had from your dad, you know, and often when we start off in life, we do need support and we do need people in our corner, and be they mentors or support systems. And it really sounds like you had that with your dad. And I'm wondering if actually maybe this fantastic career you've had, where you've gone and traveled all around and seen stuff and told thousands of stories, you know, a lot of it comes down to the support of your dad in those early travel days.
Oh, it really does. And he was a great kind of raconteur. So like with most of us, I suppose, you know, I kind of always wanted to sort of emulate my father, impress him. And I mean, he died now, 1980? What's that, 40-something years ago?
Yeah.
Poor old boy. He said to me, he rang me up, actually was not very long before he died, and he said, "Great news. I've worked out that I can live in comfort. I've got enough money to live in comfort for the rest of my life as long as I die next Thursday." And that was very much his, I miss him every single day. I really, really, very difficult man. I'm not, you know, I'm probably making him sound as though he was, Mr. Charming, but he was really difficult. I had a tremendous temper and, really, really quite hard to live with, but nevertheless, great old boy.
Without getting too psychological, often a lot of the charming people are quite difficult, actually. And a lot of the times it is a mask for deeper feelings or deeper issues in many ways. And I think a lot of the sort of more outgoing people tend to be people that actually maybe do have other problems. We don't normally get psychological on the podcast like that, but I just, that does tend to be the way sometimes, doesn't it?
I think it is, yes.
So going on from that, so obviously 17, 18, you were traveling to California and stuff, and I guess by that time you were going into university. Was you know, obviously what you have gone into, was that something that you were thinking about doing at the time? What were your sort of hopes and dreams around that time, I guess?
Well, I learned that I loved traveling, and I also had a knack for writing. I was one of those kids, and I can see it with my own son now, who's now 17. Exactly the same, you know, idle, not prepared to put the work in, but when it comes to it, he's got a writing style that makes what he's saying attractive, even though he's probably saying only about 60 or 70% of what brighter kids, better informed kids will do. He's got a way of attracting the eye of his teachers, and I had the same. I did the same, and I had the good luck to attract the eye of examiners. And so that was, I worked harder, I think, than my son does. I'm not quite sure. Nevertheless, you know, it did kind of come to something. So I always started associating, you know, writing on the one hand, writing stuff that I thought was interesting, and the desire to travel. And so, you know, I wanted, therefore I wanted to be a journalist. I did a lot of student journalism, and I that was all I could really think of. And I was fortunate in the end that the BBC hired me. They did, it turned out, I only found this out years and years later, I was a bit of a pig in a poke. They thought that I'd got a double first at Cambridge. I think because my director of studies, who was a really good friend, wrote a really glowing report on me for the BBC before I actually did the final examinations, in which I got a really crap 2-2. And you know, the BBC never asked me, did you actually get a first? And so I think they thought they were getting something an awful lot better than they actually did. But, you know, I've been with them now for 50 years.
Yeah, I was going to say,
too late now for them to chuck me out on those grounds. Lots of other grounds to chuck me out on.
It's so funny. I had a very similar experience at university because I got a 2-2 in my... I did journalism at university and I got a 2-2 in my final mark. But my course leader, a chap called Gary Edwards, so I'll never forget, with two R's. I'd never seen Gary spelled with two R's before. Gave me a glowing reference at the end of... I went to get a job on my local paper in Kent. Glowing reference saying, and James qualified with a strong 2-1. And I was thinking... No, I didn't.
I
definitely didn't, but I just left it in and no one's ever asked since.
But, you know, journalism is like lots of things. It's more about character. It's more about how you behave and everything than it is necessarily about, you know, the how big or small your brain is. And, I mean, of course, I would say this naturally because I've kind of benefited from the brain character balance. But now it's quite interesting to watch my son doing very much the same thing. And I, I've never really a sort of an employer because I've always worked within the BBC, but I've hired quite a few people. I'd always rather have people that show evidence of character than evidence of just an ability to write sensible or safe or whatever stuff. My kid at one of his schools won the prize for the boy that you would most want to go through the desert with.
I thought,
all the other kids have got, you know, classics and English and French and German, but he got the one that counted.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I also, because although all that academic stuff, the classic stuff, that can be taught and that can be learnt, but character can't be.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
So, John, what were those first kind of assignments, I guess, when you joined the BBC? What were you doing at that stage?
Well, at first I was just a sub editor. I shouldn't say just, but I hated it. You had to be sort of pinpoint accurate, needlingly accurate about everything. And I realized that the reporters were the ones that would come back and say, "God, you've never seen dozens of people arrested," and the subs would say, "How many people were arrested?" I have no idea. I mean, there were just loads and loads of them, and there was a lot of violence. And, you know, that was, and I realized that I was on the kind of there've been loads of people arrested side of the line, rather than Reuters is saying it's 21 and now you're saying it's 22. Which is it?
Also, because then if there's a complaint, it's on the subs for getting the error.
Absolutely. No, of course. You can't do it without them. I went to Northern Ireland. I really had to sort of fight my way to get there because I'd never had any experience of anything very much except nothing really. That was really quite difficult, especially, you know, for the BBC right in the middle of everything. And then I was made the BBC Ireland correspondent. So that was my first real sort of taste of what complicated, difficult stuff was, you know, with people complaining all the time, sometimes physical violence, always a threat of physical violence, but sometimes the actuality of it, getting blown up, getting shot at, all of those things. And I came out of Ireland by 1975, by the time I was 31, you know, really quite with quite a good training about how to cope with the with the world and the more difficult stories. So I was really very grateful for all that. But it took a lot of whining and complaining and pestering my bosses and everything. And then the first day I was there, I was I was very lucky to escape with my life. Just my own stupidity wandered into an IRA funeral and behaved in a stupid way that made them think I was an army spy. And I was just rescued by a wonderful old correspondent whom I'd happened to be walked down to the cemetery with. And he very wisely spotted me and came over. As they did, they'd got a gun out, and one of them, the head one, had said, give him a bullet up the nostril, which meant, you know, kill him. And they were doing various horrible things to a Daily Mirror photographer in the corner of the cemetery. So, I mean, it wasn't just, a flight of fancy. And this bloke, how wonderful, he came over and said, oh, hello, John, is it some kind of problem? And I, yes, there is some kind of problem. You're not going to kill me. But so I went back then, back to my hotel. I was very shaken up, and I sat there and I thought, you know, I'm much too sensitive for this. I feel pain too easily. You know, I should be an arts correspondent or something like that. And then I ordered a steak and a bottle of wine on room service. And after that, I kind of felt a bit better. So I decided I wouldn't put in my resignation after all. I'm glad I didn't.
I mean,
that's incredible. I was just going to say, as a first assignment, that is proper in the deep end.
It was.
In terms of sort of like on the job training.
Yes, well, you know, in those nowadays, you'd have, you know, all of the sort of training, and you'd have, you know, a bloke from the SAS, you know, with you, and so actually probably not, but that's what people like me say about the present day setup and all the health and safety stuff, because it's, but you know, I mean, I'm sufficient of a sort of management creature to realize that that's just the way the world's gone. You can't, as one individual organization, you can't say, oh, bugger all the health and safety. We're sending out our 24-year-olds to the front line. You can't do that any longer. But you could in those days. And I was a beneficiary of it, really.
Yeah, I'm still sort of slightly flabbergasted by the, you know, the just wandering into, like, you just wandering into the wrong place at the wrong time. And and I guess that must...
How stupid can you be? I'm really stupid. And I wore, you know, a sports jacket and cavalry twill trousers and brogues, because that was how I dressed in those days. And I had, the BBC had given me a magnificent little new gadget, a tiny little tape recorder about this size, instead of the monster great big Ewers that we had to carry around with us. And I had this thing in my pocket, and every now and then, I was working for radio, every now and then, every time I thought that the IRA Guard of Honor, or whatever they call themselves, who were going to fire a volley over the grave, I'd kind of pull this little thing out, thinking, God, I'm being really smooth and clever. And of course, the entire IRA leadership around the grave spotted me immediately and thought, he's dressed like a British soldier. He must be a British soldier. But I've done a lot of foolish things in my time, and that was one of the many, and I'm just fortunate enough not to have paid the price for it.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, obviously you've been in countless war zones and, you know, in difficult situations. And obviously you came to sort of that particular one, you went back to your hotel and you regrouped. Have there been other moments where you've thought, I should go and be the arts correspondent? Because I'm sure there's been lots of hairy moments for you.
There have been lots of hairy moments. I once worked it out that I'd had nine, well, actually 10, only one was a medical thing, moments where my life was, you know, in the balance. That's to say, not just somewhere where there was shooting on the other side of the road, but where there was shooting perhaps in the room where I was or right beside me or something. I've been blown up various times. No. I mean, I've long since regarded that as just the kind of stuff that happens, really. You know, the thing is, sometimes I think people get the wrong idea about these things. I mean, in an outfit, certainly like the BBC, but I think in most newspapers, most other television and radio outfits, nobody forces you to do these things. On the contrary, I mean, you know, they don't call the BBC auntie for nothing. I mean, you've really got to force your way to go to these different things, because, you know, they're constantly saying, well, you know, I think you're a bit too old. Well, they don't say that, but that's what you can tell, that's what they're thinking. You know, I think this is too dodgy, we ought to just leave this story unreported, all that kind of thing. And you have to hammer your way through it. You've got to use every means, you know, clean and dirty, to get to a difficult story now. And on various occasions, I mean, I remember that we've just had the anniversary a couple of days ago of the return of Ayatollah Khomeini to Iran in 1979. And, you know, I just off my own bat bought a ticket we were in Paris to fly with him to Tehran from Paris. And I rang the foreign editor to say, look, I've got the tickets. And he said, oh, you know, I'm ordering you not to go. And so I did that hopelessly pathetic business of saying, sorry, sorry, you know, the line's so bad here. You know what the French phones are like.
What did anyway, you say? Go, go.
I'll try and ring you back. And I got on the plane. I mean, you know, you have to do these things. And there are times, and of course, you know, we, actually not just me, but several, two or three of my colleagues got one big awards for doing that. And there are times when you've just got to say, I'm sorry, I'm here on the ground, I'm prepared to go, and by the way, I'm going. But they're so nerve-wracked nowadays. I mean, when Mosul was under the control of ISIS, I think it must have been 2016, I wanted to do some filming there. I was in Iraq anyway, and I wanted to go there and do some filming. The head of news at the time made me swear on my honor, something like 1893, you know, that I wouldn't go within 5 miles or something of Mosul. And so I swore because, you know, I'll do anything really. And and then I realized how to do it. And I just said, look, I'm in the back seat here. I'm going to go to sleep now. And you just go where you think is a good place to go. And so, you know, I felt honor was satisfied. I hadn't broken my word of honor. Well, not exactly. And the other guys were all up for going right to the center and seeing the whole thing. So I think that's what... I mean, I remember I had a girlfriend that I lived with for many years, an American television producer, great, great girl. And she said to me, somebody was saying about the dangers of journalism and everything. And she said to me, whoever said that journalism should be a safe profession? If you say that kind of thing, you're in the wrong job. Find another job. There are plenty of people that aren't terribly concerned about their personal safety, send them. And she was utterly right. And I've always quoted that ever since. Who said journalism is supposed to be a safe profession?
And that's why I lasted 2 years in journalism, doing fakes and garden parties, and that was it.
But you did the honest thing. The stuff, the aspect of it I don't like is people who really actually don't want, and why should they want to do dodgy things, but find themselves in a position where, and it happens so often, they're the one person that can look after the coverage or something. And then that moment, they decide that it's not a very good idea to stay on. And I, you know, you've got to accept people's decision. There must never be any question of forcing people to do something which they don't want. That would be absolutely wrong. It'd be wicked. But at the same time, I think you've got to have a kind of coalition of the willing, people who are prepared to do these things. And there's so many of them in so many organizations. And they're the ones that that I feel, you know, are to be praised.
I love the idea you're saying about, I mean, you've literally got more lives than a cat. You literally had 10 lives, which is, but I'm getting this sense of, like, I think that the best journalists feel like they have a duty. You know, they feel like they have a duty that kind of transcends everything, really, to follow these stories and to report the truth from these situations. But without getting sort of too dark, and I hope this is an appropriate question, you were in so many of these situations. Did you feel like you were not scared of dying at some point? Or maybe if I reframe it, did you feel like maybe you would die for the story?
Well, so of course, you never present it to yourself in that way. But probably the most dangerous thing place I ever was in Beirut in 1982 with the Israelis attacking, bombing daily, and not being interested in particularly who they bombed. And the Palestinians, the more extreme factions of the Palestinians, hunting down people like me. And that was then I remember walking down the street with somebody, and I remember thinking, I'm probably not going to get through this if I do the job. And I remember thinking then, so do I carry on doing the job, or do I go home? And I just thought, you know, I've been sent here. It costs money to send me here. People are relying on me to do the job. I think I'd just better keep on walking. And of course, so often, I mean, you know, I have had these. I've been made to kneel down, and I've had, you know, been subjected to a mock execution, and so on. That was actually in Beirut at that time, not during those months. You know, it is quite unpleasant, but somehow or another, I think it's worth risking things for. I really do. Otherwise, I've got this marvelous friend who works for the Times newspaper called Anthony Lloyd. I don't know if you've seen his stuff. He spells it with one L instead of two. And he's just magnificent. He's what I would like to be and to do. And the Times clearly doesn't tell him what to do. They just nod when he says, I'm going off to the, you know, farthest reaches of Afghanistan disguised as a, you know, something. And he always comes back with the superb stories. That's who I would like to be. And I've had this conversation with him, how much is too much? And I mean, both of us agreed that, there probably is a point at which it's too much, but neither of us had seen it. Had come to that point. And Anthony is still doing all these scenes. He's got the most amazing beard, and I'd say month after month, or perhaps every 2 months or something, there it is, front page news on the Times. You know, he's found somebody that didn't want to be found, or he's interviewed somebody that said more than they ought to have said, you know, that kind of stuff. Wonderful, wonderful stuff.
He has got a great beard. I've just Googled it. You're right. He's got a fantastic beard.
Yeah, because I guess John, you've been in all these different, like, you know, you've been in war zones, you've been in very intense places around the world. And I guess, do you sometimes, I guess, when you've been in these difficult situations and you've seen, I guess, kind of the worst parts of humanity, do you sometimes, is that a difficult balance for you? Like, only not only emotionally, but just sort of feeling a bit despairing sometimes about the world and country, and, you know, you've obviously been in some very difficult places and seen the worst sides of humanity. Is that something that ever takes a toll on you?
I suspect it must do. It does. I think these things do kind of haunt your dreams a bit. All I would say, Giles, and I mean, I've detecting you because I follow everything that you tweet and I read, I detect in you the same kind of spirit that I have. It's not that for every evil deed there's a good deed to counterbalance it, because it doesn't work like that. It frankly doesn't work. And when you think of all the evil deeds that were committed during the Second World War, you'd never be able to balance it. And the same is happening with in Ukraine with the Russian soldiers there. But to take that example, I mean, there are so many Russians who are prepared to stand up, lay flowers on that Ukrainian poet's monument in Moscow, apologize publicly, say things that, God, I'd never have the guts to do in public, shouting out, you know, in court just before their sentence, so the judge goes away and doubles the sentence, all of that kind of thing. It doesn't match individual acts of evil, but it does make you feel that it's not all evil, it's not all wickedness, it's not all cruelty and brutality, that there is some another side of the human psyche which behaves magnificently at times of trouble and danger. And that being the case, you know, you can't forget about the other stuff, but it doesn't make you feel so despairing, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I get a bit emotional when you're talking there, actually, because it's really compelling hearing you say that. And I guess as well, in all the situations you've been in, I'm thinking about that correspondent who saved you from the IRA funeral. In all these horrible situations, you must have seen so many brilliant moments of people being fantastic to each other, people reaching out with kindness, people saving each other, people in moments offering a hand, offering a leaf. You must have seen so many of those moments, even in these dark places.
I really, really have. And people that, you know, you've just got to honour you know, we kind of praise their memory. Ordinary people, not. I remember I was in what's its name? Oh dear, how really clever! You know, I'm the world editor, world affairs editor of BBC. I can't remember the name of the where it all happened. An appalling genocide and everything with the Tutsis on one side, in Rwanda.
Rwanda.
I mean, it's on every Arsenal shirt, isn't it? I should remember. Tutsis versus Hutus, and the Tutsis rose up against the Hutus, and awful things happened. I mean, people, I saw it happen, and I saw the after effects of it, and then I walked along a village street. And I saw a woman who was just sweeping up in front of her. And I started to talk to her, and it turned out she was a Hutu woman. No, she was, I think she was a Tutsi woman, and her neighbor was a Hutu. And when the gangs were hunting down the Hutus and slaughtering them, and she grabbed her next door neighbor and showed her how to hide in a ditch, the ditch that divided her small holding from the neighbor's small holding, and gave her just a straw, I don't know, made of what, to breathe through. And every night when it got dark, she'd come down and give her food and look after her. And why? You know? I mean, she could so easily have said, look, it's too dangerous for me. I don't want to get mixed up with this. I like this woman next door, but it's not my argument. And if any of those gangs had found her helping the woman, I mean, she would have been slaughtered right then and there. You know, what makes people do these things? I don't know. It's one of the most interesting subjects, really. Where does our better... We all know where our worst nature comes from. I mean, I could slaughter the kid opposite for playing loud music. But what makes people put their entire lives and perhaps sometimes the lives of their families on the line just to do what they ought to do? Magnificent.
Yeah.
The right thing, doing the right thing.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it's character. And it's a very emotive thing you're saying, John, and I can feel the emotion in you, and I'm feeling emotional about it, because again, often that's maybe something we don't see necessarily in the mainstream media either. We don't get to see those moments of compassion and humanity.
I didn't report that because I thought it might cause the woman some problems, but I should have. I bloody well should have. But there are the people that are prepared to go and help when, you know, one bomb has gone off and you know that the tactic of these bastards is to put another one directly, the rescue people work there. But they don't sit back and say, I think we ought to wait here for an hour or so, you know, in case there's another bomb. They go in there. And that we do see, of course. Mm.
Yeah,
I mean, I think we talk about this a lot on the podcast. Like, and obviously, we are talking to people about sort of difficult moments in their lives and careers, and so a lot of the stuff we talk about is quite sort of heavy. But one of the overriding themes, I guess, from this pod is that there's a lot of good in the world, and people are inherently good, I guess. And that's, I think, sometimes it's really difficult to remind yourself that. Especially if you look on social media and Twitter and the news and stuff, like, I think it's just important to remind yourself that there are good people out there. It could be in your town, your city, and other countries. They are.
Also, I'd go further than that and say, I think almost everybody, or at least a big majority of people, know that they ought to behave well. I met one of the most awful people I ever met was during the period of the disappearances in Argentina, when something like 30,000 people were kidnapped, tortured, almost always tortured, and almost always killed in awful ways. And I was there during that period, and I went back afterwards to write a book about it. And one of the people, I managed to track down a man who was at the worst of the torture places, and he looked an absolute brute. I mean, your heart would fail if he walked into the room with a set of electrodes, you know, and I talked to him for a long time, and he had worked out a kind of strategy, mental strategy, for denying that he'd ever actually done anything. He'd been there, yes, he'd helped to kidnap some of the people. He'd seen them just before they were tortured, and he'd gone out of the room for some reason, and he'd come back at the end when the torture had finished. And of course, what had really happened was that he had been the torturer, but he knew that that wasn't the right. He knew that was wrong, yeah. and that he had been wrong to do it. And he'd already by that stage. I interviewed him in jail, so he couldn't have made his own case worse by that stage. They'd seen him. They'd given him life, I think, and that was going to be it. So he wasn't saying it in order to get a lighter sentence or anything. He was doing it because he knew he shouldn't have been doing any of those things. And he just kind of pretended that he wasn't a part of it because he knew it was wrong.
That is fascinating. I mean, the sort of human psyche fascinates me anyway, but the mental gymnastics that he is doing to... Yes.
How could he, you know, why didn't he just say, yeah, I did it and I probably shouldn't have, you know, but to try and pretend he hadn't been there any of the difficult moments are extraordinary. But you're right. I mean, what a complicated thing the human brain is, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. Now, John, you've been in lots of conflicts. You've seen what's going on in the Ukraine now. And I know you're well versed in Vladimir Putin and his motives and stuff. How do you see things sort of, I mean, you might not be able to answer this, but how do you see things currently panning out with that conflict?
Well, I'm actually just going back in a week or so to interview Zelensky again, and I hope to be able to travel around a bit. The newspapers are full of stories which the Ukrainians are pumping out that there'll be a big new phase in the war on the anniversary, around the anniversary, 24th or 23rd, 25th, you know, something like that. I hope to be there when that happens. I mean, one thing, you know, one of the things that really irritates me actually is people saying, oh, you know, we should just have peace. Well, of course we should have peace, of course. But when in a war like this, there's only peace when either one side realizes it's losing or when both sides realize that they can't win. And we aren't at that stage yet. Terrible thing to say that more and more and more people are going to have to die until it's clear which way the war's going. We thought a month or so ago that it was all going Ukraine's way. It isn't. The Russians have got a second breath. They found people who are prepared to give them weapons. And Ukraine is up against it. If, and of course these are always big ifs, if Ukraine can hold the Russian advances back in at the end of next month, then I think the Russians will have to acknowledge that they're not getting anywhere whatsoever. They're not going to win. And that might be the point at which Putin then starts to say, well, maybe we should negotiate something. I mean, you can see the possibility of an outline peace once Ukraine has won. You could see that. I mean, there are people in eastern Ukraine who really don't want to be Ukrainian, and you know, it can't be beyond the wit of human intelligence to be able to draw a line around those who want to be part of Russia, voluntarily, actively want to be part of Russia, and those who really, really don't. There are some things which I don't think Ukraine can give up on, which is particularly Crimea. I think it has to have Crimea, even though it had a Russian beforehand. It used to have a Russian majority. But nevertheless, people did want to be part, basically wanted it to be part of Ukraine. It was taken off them in 2014 illegally by illegal wrong methods, which countered all the principles of the United Nations. I think they can't, if they're going to win, they can't win without having Crimea back. So, but, you know, honestly, if you say this to Ukrainians, and I don't blame them, they go absolutely berserk. They want their country as it was the day before Russia invaded. And I mean, that is, you know, it's so, it must be so right. It's like saying, you know, we're not going to have Northumberland anymore. You know, we'll give it away just simply because somebody else wanted it to take it off us. I mean, there's no rationale that justifies taking these things off. But, you know, that is what happens at the end of a war. You do get a peace. The alternative is that Putin will, somebody will tap him on the shoulder and say, look, you know, this isn't working. And either, I mean, there's this appalling man, Prigozhin, who runs the Wagner group of mercenaries. He seems to have all sorts of ideas of his own about what he'd like to do. And who knows, he may be the one that taps Putin on the shoulder, in which case it'd probably be even worse than it is under Putin. Alternatively, there may be somebody that approved of the war initially, but now says, you know, it ain't working. We've got to reach a peace agreement, and that the peace agreement will be that Ukraine goes back to the moment before Russia started stealing its territory. So, you know, I've got a bad record of prognostication, because I'm too optimistic about things. I always see people come to terms and be sensible and shake hands and forget it. And of course, that often doesn't happen. But those are two of the possibilities. I mean, I suppose a third possibility is that Russia would defeat. I can't believe that they can with all of that support they're getting from NATO. Mm. I can't see that Russia can win this.
It's interesting, John. I was going to say, because obviously you've probably been looking from afar or up close as well with Putin over the years, and obviously the beginning of his ruling when he took over as president, it was very kind of the country became a lot more affluent, and they felt like he was sort of integrating Russia into the political sphere of in the global sense, and that has kind of ebbed away over the years. Were you surprised that this was the eventual outcome?
Oh yes. Oh, I still find it hard to come to terms with it. I met Putin on various occasions. I actually met him on the day, or one of the earliest days of his political career, when he was just the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. Can't say I remember much about him actually from that time, but I have seen him various times afterwards. Always been impressed by his intelligence. And actually, personally, just away from everybody, was really rather pleasant to me and friendly, and said he watched the BBC every day to improve his English. There you are. That's not something I'm boasting about. I won't be telling the Daily Mail about that one. But clearly, that business of, you know, Russia used to be all powerful, and then the stab in the back, you know, the collapse, all of these things, NATO trying to grab hold of Russia's neighbors. I mean, actually, I've been at reported on some of those meetings. The NATO people were really reluctant to take most of these countries in. I mean, I wouldn't say all of them. I think the Baltic states, they were probably thought that they ought to take in. But in various other cases, it was quite clear that they were nervous about it, didn't want it. The idea that NATO's gone pushing, demanding, forcing Poland, forcing Romania, Bulgaria, the others to join, absolute nonsense. I mean, I remember hearing George H.W. Bush, the clever one of the two presidents, saying, talking about this precise issue, you know, should we do it? And he said that, you know, it's dangerous because it could inflame Russia. But he said, I remember him saying, how can one free nation or a group of free nations like NATO say to a country that's so nervous of Russia that it wants NATO membership, you're on your own, boys. We're not having you. So Putin still seems to have this bitterness about the way that Russia ended, and it seems to have got so much worse. And it seems to have got worse during the COVID period when he was almost on his own. He just had, as far as I know, three people that he talked to. And who knows? I mean, I don't know whether he's ill or not. I mean, you read all these stories, but I've got no indication of that. But if he isn't well and he's taking some weird pills, God knows how they may affect him too. But I'll tell you, I've sat listening to I think it was a 4-hour press conference he gave 5-6 years ago. And I mean, he gives them every year, except this year I noticed he didn't, which may indicate that he is ill. He'd just sit there and the entire world's press and the entire press of Russia, which is vast, were allowed to come and ask questions. And some of the questions were really, really complicated about oil pricing policy and so on. He didn't have a piece of paper in front of him, and he answered brilliantly. He answered questions of people like me about the political direction. And then, you know, there was, I forget what, Ladies Weekly from Smolensk or something. And she put her hand up and he said, yes, the beautiful lady in line 3, you know, because, of course, you know, you can say those kind of things in Russia where you wouldn't dare say them anywhere else. And the lady from Smolensk or whatever said, why are you always putting off getting married? You've got this nice girl. Why don't you just marry her and have kids? And, you know, he answered that, batted that away with great sort of grace and wit. And you think, what a shame that this man has taken this direction, you know. And he hasn't been forced. I mean, nobody wants an angry, violent, dangerous Russia. You know, sorry, I'm bad.
No, not at all.
It's fascinating.
Such brilliant
it's
insight.
It's really interesting. Yeah, and he's an interesting character, isn't he? I got two questions, if that's okay. I got one for our public feed, and then, Giles, I've got a question for our patrons as well to round off on. But just with all the things you've seen, and you've talked so emotionally, and I can sort of hear the emotion in your voice recounting so many of these stories, but with such a long career seeing such, well, I guess a range of horrible things and nice things, do you or have you become desensitized to a lot of the sort of horrors that you see? Is that a thing that all journalists end up doing?
I can only really talk about myself. I'm one or two close friends who I think would feel the same way about me. On the contrary, I mean, I'm afraid I think it sensitizes you more. And of course, also getting old makes you a bit more emotional too. So maybe there's a bit of that as well. But no, I feel more kind of emotionally committed to people when you see them suffering. I feel more angry about the brutality and cruelty of the people. I don't think it's had that effect on me. It doesn't stop me making jokes about all sorts of things, because that making jokes is a way in which you kind of cope with it, I think. I mean, to my immense embarrassment, about a year ago, I was in Afghanistan and I was spending time with a family who genuinely didn't know whether they were going to be able to live through the winter because of the hunger that was taking over, and little kids, you know, a kid like my two daughters used to be, and like a kid the age of my son now. And I came back directly from that, walked back, and did a live interview on the Today program. And somebody said, you know, what have you seen? And I started telling you this story. And I just had a vision of my daughters and my grandchildren. And, I kind of choked up. And people were very nice about it afterwards. And they said that it, and some people said it gave them a real sense of the importance. And but I felt, and I've always felt ever since, that that was absolutely appalling thing to do. You know, what do you, the BBC spends thousands of quid sending people around to weep on television, on radio. I mean, really. And I thought of all the sort of grandees of the BBC that I'd known over the years, Charles Wheeler, and you know, all the Robin Day. Imagine, God, get them together. And did you see what that stupid ass Simpson did? You know? It just, I've felt bad about it ever since. But at least it I suppose it shows I'm not being desensitized. Yeah, to
quite
things.
Absolutely. No, you're right. And I think people showing emotion, I think, is a good thing. And
as long as they don't do it too much, I don't want to hear too much.
I think being a parent just changes you. I think it makes you more emotional as well. So I think there's that element, yeah, as well. But
John, it's been such a great pleasure to talk to you, and thank you so much for your time. And it's been pretty
cool. Honestly, Giles, I really love reading your stuff, and it does sometimes when you do feel a bit down or worried, you know, you just manage to get that positive side of things, which makes life, you know, just that little bit brighter, really.
Oh, well, that's so kind of you.
Please don't stop doing that.
That's so kind of you to say, and I really, really appreciate that.
That's true. And you're both lovely questions from the two of you. My God, if only, you know, we should do this, you know, more often.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. I'll be so many.
For you to say that, to hear that from you, it's really
you know what I mean. Yeah, it's such a lovely. I hope to meet you both.
Oh, yeah, that would be lovely. Yes.
That'd be lovely.
Yeah.
We'd love that. Yes, please. Thanks, John. John Simpson on the Blank Podcast. What a man. Literally, it's all I can say. A man. Just legend, you know, legend of TV and radio, but also just legend of a person as well. I mean, that was such a lovely chat. It was informative. It was emotional. It was funny. I'd say that's one of our best episodes ever.
Yeah, it was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And like I say, particularly that story he told about Rwanda and the humanity shown by people from the lady from either the Tutsi or the Hutu, and how they helped their neighbour out who was that really got me, and I could tell
it's unimaginable. You
can't imagine it, can you? Like the worst possible circumstances, and and obviously he told the story with much with the same sort of humanity that he witnessed, but yeah, I was very emotional, and obviously John was very emotional about it as well. And it was, you know, it was nice that he felt comfortable to talk to us about that. You know, and so many different things he's seen, so many horrendous things that he must have witnessed, but yet he can still come away feeling that there is good in the world. And that, you know, like I mentioned on the podcast, we don't often get to see that necessarily in the mainstream media, but we know that, you know, quite a lot of people, or most people, there's good in them. You know, even the worst people, there's some good in there. And that's something I guess we have to cling on to, you know, throughout our lives, that, you know, there is more good in the world than bad.
I think as well, I think if you're feeling down about the world, and I 100% understand, because I do as well, and I think it's, as John said, it's a tough time right now. If there's one person in the world that legitimately could feel down about the world, it's John. Yeah. And the fact that he is choosing to find the positive in things, I think is a good indicator for all of us that we can do the same. And that's really my main takeaway from today. Someone that's seen the atrocities that he's seen still chooses to believe the best in not just like most people, in all people, I think is a really powerful takeaway from today's episode.
Yeah, I mean, if you've been nearly killed many times or blown up, as he said once, and you've, go on like Wikipedia and see the number of things that John has witnessed, you know, Tiananmen Square, Iraq, Afghanistan, front lines in war zones, Ukraine. He said, told us he's off to the Ukraine again very soon to interview Volodymyr Zelensky. So like he's on the front lines of the most, you know, most dangerous situations possible. And yet he's still choosing to be able to see the best in stuff, you know, and so that says a lot about the man.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've got to go because someone's dropping on some new car keys for me. So
nice.
sorry to change tack. My friend Paul, my car key's broken. My friend Paul from down the road has
finally
bought me some new ones. Well, bought me the shell. He's going to come around and try and fix it.
Cool. Well, where will I go then?
He's a legend, Paul. Anyway, thank you to John so much for sharing his immense insight and just being a legend. And thank you to our listeners and our patrons, of course. We love this extra story with John.
Really good one this week. Really good.
At our patron. patreon.com/blankpodcast. And thank you, Giles, you know, for just being you. It's nice seeing your face every Friday.
Well, likewise, Jim. And, you know, this is our little therapy session. But, you know, I took so much away from today's conversation. Like you said, I'm going to, like you said at the top of the pod, that it's going to stay with you. I think it's certainly going to stay with me today as well.
Definitely. And we'll stay with you next week, listeners. Did that work? Doesn't really work. with another guest on the Blank Podcast. Until then, take care of yourselves. And most importantly, Giles,
don't get cancelled.
Media Podcast.